If you are a cardiologist and you write books entitled Curing the Incurable and Death by Calcium, you are not only stepping out of the Western medical model, but you are also very curious and brave. Dr. Thomas Levy is the doctor, and today we'll mostly be discussing high-dose vitamin C, one of his specialties, and the subject of his book, Curing the Incurable. Let's help him get the word out. I'm Robin, and this is Tributaries. Thomas, before we dive into some particulars about your work, vitamin C and calcium, if there's time, I just wanted to thank you for being such a tireless advocate for restoring some kind of actual health care in this world. And when I was writing this out, I thought calling you extremely knowledgeable felt like I was selling you short. So thank you for all of the work you've done.
Okay, well, I appreciate those sentiments. Thank you.
Your medical career originally was focused on cardiology. What was the sequence of events that lifted you over into questioning some of the basics in medicine and researching the possibilities using high-dosage vitamin C therapy?
Well, that all pretty much happened when I was in Colorado Springs in 1994, and I happened to meet Dr. Hal Huggins, a dentist who has been a proponent against mercury and other dental infections as being toxic sources for a long time now. I got to know him. I eventually saw him at his clinic, and I saw some of the things he was doing. And to make a long story short, I saw extremely ill patients of all variety not only get better after they got their dental work addressed and they were on proper supplements, but they also showed immediate substantial improvement when they got these large intravenous infusions of vitamin C, usually 50-gram infusion over a few hours. And I said, my goodness, nobody's ever said anything about vitamin C to me in my life. And I simply said, I got to find out more about this, do my own research, do my own due diligence. And I ended up in fairly short order giving up my cardiology practice completely, working as a consultant to Dr. Huggins' clinic, then eventually going to law school, writing my books, and lecturing in various places around the world up to this point in time.
What brought in the law school?
You know, I saw Dr. Huggins getting besieged by so many ridiculous little legal matters. He actually had a lawyer on retainer. And at that point in time, I had the time. For some crazy reason, I had the inclination, and I said, I think I'll just be better off and better able to protect myself and be able to proceed unimpeded in my mission for what I would call health freedom, that I decided to go to law school. And I did a 3-year program at Denver University School of Law and commuted between back and forth between Colorado Springs and Denver. And it has changed my perspective on a lot of things. I certainly have not practiced a day of law in my life, but it has given me a different slant on writing, a different slant on thinking, and a different slant on how best to defend myself and my rights.
I'm kind of curious what the difference in thinking, what did it broaden or bring up for you?
It's hard to put it into words. There's a certain logic that follows out of a legal training in as far as writing goes. It sort of merged the legal style with the medical style and made me very more aware of statements that should be qualified in a certain manner. I mean, long time ago, I realized you can't put anything in an email, for an example, that you can't deal with if it's read out loud in a court of law. People just think they're sitting in their houses and they're writing anything they want about anybody they want in any manner that they want. Hey, guess what? It could end up being read out loud and read into the record in a court of law, depending on what happens. So it just increased my awareness on how to best present myself, my ideas, and try to get something positive accomplished before I finish up this lifetime.
thank you for accomplishing so much. And I think someone somewhere should apologize for needing a law degree to practice medicine. But certainly when you're after something like healthcare freedom, it was a very wise move on your part. And historically, it seems Linus Pauling is the name that comes up to most people regarding vitamin C. What historically did you bump into that really got your juices flowing?
Irwin Stone wrote a book and was a associate of Dr. Pauling, and it was covering vitamin C and toxins and infections. And when I looked at that book, I saw all the information that was there, all the documentation. And then I just began about a 3 or 4 year project to put together as many articles as I could for the book that I wrote, Curing the Incurable, Vitamin C, Infectious Diseases and Toxins. And I realized then that I needed to look at the backgrounds of all the pioneers, if you will, in alternative medicine, orthomolecular medicine, anybody who would present a point of view that was contrary to the mainstream mantra. And there was just so much information there that eventually led to 10 more books. But I guess the most impressive thing is it's hiding in plain sight. All this information is there. When people seem just astounded, or physicians who are legitimately open-minded seem astounded, the information is all there. It's not half-baked ideas on my part. Everything derives from the refereed, peer-reviewed scientific literature.
Vitamin C certainly is known as an absolute viricide. And could you give an example or an experience that you've had working with someone or someone close to you that had with vitamin C cure? And then maybe we can move into other properties about it.
Well, sure. As you just pointed out, vitamin C is an absolute viricide or an absolute virus neutralizer, depending on how you want to look at it, since viruses are not considered really living entities. They just live on something else. And certainly, I was unable to encounter, as a physician, all the different diseases that Irwin Stone wrote about and Dr. Frederick Klenner treated. But yes, in direct answer to your question, I had a couple of individuals with West Nile virus in Colorado. I was in Colorado at the time. One was a college student who was so sick, he'd pretty much dropped out of college and had been sick for months. Another individual was a much older individual, started to get liver dysfunction secondary to the virus. And both of them were completely symptom-free, with normalizing laboratory that eventually normalized in short order after 2 days of vitamin C infusions. So I didn't have a hard time imagining that the other viruses, if I were able to encounter them, would react the same.
When you work with vitamin C, we're talking large doses. What the government tells us in their recommended daily allowances and what is needed to actually create a difference in the body is a huge amount, isn't it?
Yes. You know, they have studies on animals that synthesize their own vitamin C inside their body. And for example, a 150-pound goat, average size of a person, let's say, will make 10 to 15,000 milligrams, 10 to 15 grams a day under normal circumstances and secrete it directly into the blood. And if you give that goat a life-threatening exposure to a toxin or an infection, the internal production can ramp up to 100 grams a day. So nature has provided the template that tells us what doses of vitamin C are appropriate and best. Man has largely lost the ability to make vitamin C like the other animals, along with the primates and the fruit bats and the guinea pigs. But it does appear that when this enzyme in the liver is unleashed, the amount of vitamin C that you end up producing and needing is vastly, vastly beyond the absolute minimalist anti-scurvy doses recommended by the government and the public health authorities.
So are you saying when someone is inflicted with a virus or an infection, that the body will start making more vitamin C?
A vitamin C synthesizing animal will start making more.
Right.
No.
What was the
most men, women, and children will just get sick, and until you come in with an intervention to deal with the afflicting toxin or the afflicting infection, you get no resolution.
Right.
Very interesting. I didn't come here with this mind, but there is some new data that shows that there are some supplements out there, polyphenols, that are actually turning out to activate the enzyme, the genetic reading of the RNA in the liver to make the enzyme galactose oxidase and synthesize your own vitamin C. That hasn't been definitively proven, but the early studies on this supplement are very promising. I mean, anybody that's interested in that, I would encourage him. There's a website, formula216.com.
That's amazing. What historically or evolutionarily do you see the reason why we wouldn't be able to synthesize our own vitamin C?
As it turns out, and it's discussed on the website in greater detail to anybody that's interested, there is evidence that indicates, for example, fetuses make a huge amount of vitamin C, and babies, young, and some small children continue to make vitamin C after they're born. Well, you know, you can't be a little bit pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. So it appears that man can make vitamin C. It's just there are epigenetic factors that keep this particular gene, RNA, from being transcribed and producing the protein. And certain supplements strongly impact the ability or appear to strongly affect the ability of the RNA to be transcribed and the protein to be produced, and in this case, the vitamin C to be synthesized.
One thing that comes to my mind when speaking about this is my grandmother told me how she got one orange to eat all winter when it appeared in her Christmas stocking. And must have been a good day. So why do you think oranges, first of all, they aren't really the highest form of vitamin C, but they certainly have that reputation now. And then what do you think has happened to necessitate the need for extra vitamin C?
Well, I don't know how it got started with oranges. Probably the fact that the British sailors that got scurvy eventually resolve when they start bringing limes on board. So it's another citric fruit, and maybe that somehow got passed along to orange juice and oranges. I'm not sure, but okay. The human being has not increased its need for vitamin C per se. It's never produced it, at least statistically in a large number of people. It's never been produced, which is why, in my opinion, so many people beyond the age of 40 are on a progressively larger amount of prescription medicines. I mean, it's not normal to get high blood pressure. It's not normal to get cancer. It's not normal to get fibromyalgia, lupus, any of these other diseases. These are all diseases of increased oxidative stress, exposure to toxins, and vitamin C is the natural combatant for anything that increases oxidative stress, which means toxins, which means infections. So no, although I will say our need is even increasing more because we're exposed to more and more and more toxins than we've ever been exposed to before.
Yes.
But man has always been, as a species, very deficient, too absent, depending on the person, in making vitamin C.
Okay, so that brings up the subject of getting vitamin C into the system. Natural, synthetic?
This drives some people who want everything to be natural crazy, but vitamin C is a very simple molecule, and the molecule can be harvested from natural substances. It can be synthesized in the laboratory, but the molecule is identical. So as long as you have proper purification processes, there's no need to go crazy over the fact that you don't have a natural vitamin C. It's a straightforward molecule that has the ability to donate two electrons to substances that are oxidized or toxins, etc. So in that regard, you just want pure forms. And with regard to routine supplementation, aside from something like the formula 216 that appears to keep a certain baseline of vitamin C in your system, far and away, and I recommend both. I don't recommend just one or the other. I recommend the formula 216 plus a regular dose, usually if it can afford it, because it's a little pricier, liposome encapsulated vitamin C, and sodium ascorbate powder. All of these things are good ways to get vitamin C in your system, and generally it has to do with your financial resources and how much time you want to dedicate to taking something. A lot of people don't want to be bothered with taking something more than once a day. And if you take regular forms of vitamin C, you don't keep the levels up to the type of levels that are optimal if you don't take it, if you take it three or four times a day. But taking the liposome forms, which are a little more costly, the form that Livon Labs has pioneered, this is an excellent way to keep your vitamin C level up, especially in conjunction with this supplement that appears to help unleash your liver to synthesize your own vitamin C as well. Both of them work very well together.
In my reading, I came across something that seemed to intimate that if you're on a high dose of vitamin C and then you stop taking it cold, that can create a problem in the body. Is that true, or did I misunderstand that?
There have been some talk in the literature of rebound effects or rebound scurvy. Many years ago, I thought it was real, but as time goes on and I've seen more situations, I don't think it's a real phenomenon. And if it is real, it's very minimal in its impact. The theory was that if you take a lot of vitamin C for a long time and then you stop, enzymes start chewing up remainder vitamin C you have in your body and you can go into scurvy easier. I really don't think that happens. But a very practical point is, let's say you're a regular doser of vitamin C and other quality supplements, you get in a car accident, you're in the hospital, and then you're not taking anything for a week or two, a lot of problems can develop when you are unable to continue your supplementation, because everything about a hospitalization, trauma, infection, procedures, all of these things create oxidative stress and increase vitamin C utilization inside your body. So the more you could get when you're in the hospital, I guarantee you, the quicker you're going to recover from whatever your circumstance is.
Right. And it would seem certainly if you knew you were going into a surgery, it would be smart to start dosing ahead of time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Whenever there's trauma involved, whenever there's surgery involved, whenever there's infection involved, there's going to be an increased consumption of vitamin C. So even individuals who don't want to review the literature and say, why are you taking all this vitamin C? Well, if you do vitamin C levels on hospitalized patients, they're almost uniformly depressed. And in the sickest patients, sometimes it's hard to find any measurable vitamin C at all. So even if you don't think vitamin C has these incredible antitoxin, anti-infection properties, you just did a blood test and found out an important nutrient or vitamin is low in your system. So you should give those patients vitamin C to at least normalize their blood test.
And with taking vitamin C, are there any concerns if you have high vitamin C then I need to be taking vitamin D to keep up with it or to balance it? How does that work?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about that. I'm not aware of any significant scientific data that shows vitamin C has some reciprocal relationship with other nutrients, like the more you take of it, the more you're going to knock the other one down. Those relationships do exist with different minerals, et cetera, but not to my awareness with vitamin C. However, I'm not a mono-supplement type of person. Vitamin C is important, but it's hard to make an argument that it's more important than magnesium, than vitamin D, than vitamin K, because all of these things help regulate calcium metabolism, which is absolutely pivotal in determining how well your oxidative stress is dealt with. Because vitamin C, vitamin D, magnesium, and vitamin K individually, as individual supplements, have been established to reduce all-cause mortality. In other words, you dose these supplements and they decrease your chance statistically significantly from dying from anything. So this means it's having a positive effect on all the cells of the body, just not one organ or one disease process or one infection. They increase the immune integrity of every cell in the body, resistant to oxidative stress, And when cells have lesser oxidative stress, they live longer. It's that simple.
Right, less of a battle going on within the body. And something else I noticed about the vitamin C is that not only does it kill virus, but it also rids lingering pharmaceutical toxins in the body.
Well, yes. You see, this might sound simplistic, but I guarantee you, even though it's simplistic, it's quite accurate. And that is, all symptomatology, all negative symptoms from anything, from a disease, from a toxin, from a pharmaceutical drug that actually has toxic properties. All these things induce oxidative stress. And vitamin C is your prototypical antioxidant that gets through all the cells of the body, crosses the blood-brain barrier, donates two electrons rather than one, and is highly important in recharging other important antioxidants in your body, like your intracellular levels of glutathione. It's just an absolute critical thing to maintain the levels of, and it needs to be taken in conjunction with other supplements because they all work together. But it's not good to be too faddish on one thing. If you took nothing else, you should take vitamin C and magnesium. But obviously, I think there's a lot more important things, including vitamin D. I call magnesium, vitamin C, vitamin D, and vitamin K the big four.
Sorry, are you talking vitamin K2?
K2 is the most important one, but I'm talking about a K complex. Yes, the more K2 you can take, the better. That's the portion of vitamin K that's been found to be most operative in the regulation of calcium metabolism. And you had mentioned earlier to me about my book, Death by Calcium. That's why calcium does what it does. It's absolutely essential at lower levels, and at higher levels, it's highly toxic. So we have this crazy idea that women with osteoporosis don't have enough calcium in their bones. Well, yeah, because the bones are oxidized. They're in bad shape. But when you treat just with calcium, you don't restore new bone, but you deposit a lot of calcium throughout the body, and you increase calcium levels inside the cells, and this is highly toxic and will promote the appearance and furtherance of any chronic degenerative disease, including heart disease, including cancer.
That is also something that the more we can get out, the better we all will be, because that is just a huge myth that's breaking down at this time, I believe, and I'm so glad that it is. You know, in reading about...
Calcium is still one of the most widely sold supplements on the planet, so we're making progress, but we're not close to truly enlightening the public and the physicians, but we're getting there.
Yes, and something like Tums, for instance, people apparently are eating those like candy, and they have the worst kind of calcium, in my mind, or that I've learned, that is possible to even take.
That's spot on. Tums and Rolaids, you take one Tums and you're getting the calcium level of an entire glass of milk, maybe 10 ounces of milk, something along those lines. And let me tell you, that's far, far too much toxin. So if you are having an upset stomach, or every night after dinner before you go to bed, you're taking two or three Tums, or two or three Rolaids, boy, are you increasing your chances of heart disease, cancer, and just about everything else. The unfortunate thing, actually, about those over-the-counter agents is that they work so well. There's no question calcium carbonate knocks out an acid stomach in seconds. So it's very hard for people that have these type of conditions to not end up gravitating toward a solution like this to their discomfort. But I can just tell you, sodium bicarbonate, okay, they make sodium bicarb pills and sodium bicarbonate in the box. That's the way to go for your acid discomfort. Most of the other ones have calcium and are going to do you a lot more harm than good in the long run.
Oh, that's a great tip. You know, I was looking at some of the history, and boneset is a tree that was used medicinally, seemingly for colds and flus and being a vericide, but it made me wonder, because it was named boneset, that there was a connection between calcium and vitamin C and how it worked in the body.
You know, that may well be. I've heard of boneset. I'm not too familiar with it in terms of its properties and what it does inside the body. But I tell you what, there's a lot of great things that you can tell things about by their name. There's a plant called Palma Christi, which produces castor oil, which has a wide number of applications that are not widely appreciated by medicine. And what does Palma Christi mean? Palma Christi means hands of Christ. So you can see how, in the days of yore, how different things might get different names depending on their effects. So I know what you mean.
Yeah, yeah. My gosh, as I knew this half hour would go very, very fast, Thomas, you've written a lot of books, so share in a moment about another topic that either you've written a book on or that is holding your interest at this moment.
Okay, well, the recent book, Hidden Epidemic, in a nutshell, shows that a huge number of people have completely pain-free but chronically infected teeth. And this, in fact, is the reason for a majority of chronic degenerative diseases on the planet. And there's a new technology in dentistry called 3D X-ray, 3D cone beam imaging, that has to be done if you want to make sure that you don't have a chronically infected tooth causing your cancer, causing your heart disease, causing your joint pain, anything like that, because the evidence is strong now that dental toxins and dental pathogens, and I'm talking about tonsils, I'm talking about gums, okay, and teeth. And these are strongly, strongly cause and effect with all diseases. Inside the coronary arteries, people that get heart disease, studies show well over 90%, and some studies show 100% of those plaques have loads of dental pathogens inside them. Now, that's the reason, I think, very clear-cut why most of our atherosclerosis evolves. So I have books written on all of this, The Toxic Tooth, Hidden Epidemic, Stop America's Number One Killer, goes into the physiology of heart disease and the pathophysiology of atherosclerosis. And most of the information is on my website, peakenergy.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you very, very much. Appreciate you sharing with us today. Thank you, Dr. Thomas Levy. Great, great information. Spread the word, everybody. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is on iTunes as Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.